In a way, aren't we all Spartacus?
It's Flicks and That with Steve Newell. Hi, Steve.
Kia ora, Barney. What a lovely surprise today.
I know, I feel so happy to see you because you're somebody that I know. And it's nice to talk to someone I know. First of all, can you hear this bed?
Yeah, I can hear some bed. I'll take a bit more. Take a little bit more bed. That's a good bed.
Yeah, you can hear that.
That's cozy. I like that.
Okay, cool. I can't hear it, but as long as you can. No, sorry. Let's talk about movies.
Let's talk about movies and shows and stuff.
Yeah.
Movies and shows and stuff. Well, let's start with the a bit of a note on the continual astronomic success of local film Tinar. Which opened 4 weeks ago now and has stayed at the top of the New Zealand box office the whole time.
That's so good.
This is really, it's a heartwarming film, but this the success of this film is also great to see.
Yeah.
As I look at this list in front of me, I can see that it's rapidly climbing up the highest grossing New Zealand films of all time. This is the not adjusted for inflation list, right? So apply any kind of cynicism factors about how movie tickets cost more than they used to or whatever, but still, like, it's, you know, this is the top 20 list. This is the real list. And Tinar has overtaken What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. It's now the seventh highest grossing New Zealand film of all time.
Holy moly. And how many weeks has it been?
4 weeks. It's crazy.
That's cool. That's hard these days.
That's hard. Looking at, I think it's box office has dropped by about 20% this week, which is really not what you'd expect from a film sort of at this stage in its lifespan. It's working on great word of mouth has supported this. And while the story of a sort of culture clash of Samoan teacher and the choir of, well, the newly formed choir of a Christchurch posh school may seem very familiar, and it's got lots of familiar beats to it, it's a very, very good example of its genre. So I think it's both a case of having a very kind of crowd-pleasing format,
yeah,
but also being a very, very good example of it.
I was just down in Palmerston North on the weekend, and everyone was going to see it there.
They're going to see it bloody everywhere, by the looks of it. So next in its sights, it's on track to probably overtake Sione's Wedding in the top 10 sometime in the next week or so. But then there's a bit of a distance to make up to the... let's count the top five. The next one, number five, would be Whale Rider.
Uh-huh.
Number four is Once Warriors. Number three, World's Fastest Indian. And then a double-barreled Taika Waititi with Boy and Hunt for Wilder People, still the all-time Kiwi champ.
So Foot Roads Flats isn't even in that.
Oh, it's in the rear view.
A Dog's Tale.
It's in the rear view now. Oh. Yeah, yeah. Tinar's left What We Do in the Shadows and the Dust, Foot Roads Flats, The Dark Horse, etc., etc.
Oosh.
Nice to see it all rolling so well. What it has done, possibly, is taken a little bit of the oxygen out of the room for another Aotearoa feature, which is the Rule of Jenny Penn.
This is the
second film by New Zealand director James Ashcroft. His Coming Home in the Dark is a great chilling thriller that also kind of wove in a bunch of New Zealand's troubled boys' home history into it. And The Rule of Jenny Penn arrived here after a bunch of international acclaim and powered by performances by international heavyweights John Lithgow and Geoffrey Rush.
Mm.
We were mentioning... I hate this radio thing. Hey, just before we came on air, we're talking about this thing. But just before we came on air, we're talking about New Zealand accents. And John Lithgow has had a really good crack at the New Zealand accent.
Is he really?
Film.
I love that.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like in that television... my God. I'm being that guy that doesn't know the TV show that he's trying to think of. You know the one that was set down in the late Holly Hunter... And then Elizabeth Shue became the detective, and she had to do like a New Zealand
Top of the Lake.
Top of the Lake,
or was it Shorten Street? No, it's Top of the Lake.
Top of the Lake.
Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, does he pull it off?
There's been a couple of successful examples, of the international Kiwi accent, and there's been a bunch of why did you just decide? Maybe you should have just made them not a New Zealander, you know?
Yeah.
But Lithgow's really good at it, and as much as anything else. As much as the great achievement of sounding authentically Kiwi, he's also freaking frightening in this movie. He is summoning the kind of scary role that we haven't seen from him for some time. It's kind of easy to think of him as like this kind of, cheerful, cheeky granddad of Hollywood, I guess, a little bit at this time.
I think of him as a Martian.
Yeah, totally. But again, like, you know, pretty loosey-goosey performance, pretty friendly comedic, but he has got these sort of villainous roles in his past. He's got a couple of really good Brian De Palma ones up his sleeve. So seeing Menace delivered with a New Zealand accent is, well, that's two times James Ashcroft has done that in his film career so far. The Rule of Jenny Penn's well worth checking out. But yes, you can be forgiven if all the conversation about the local film industry is about Tina at the moment.
And how's the incredible Yvette Parsons? And she's in Rule of Jenny Penn, I think. Do you know what I'm talking about?
There are so many great faces in this film, like to the point where Ashcroft's even got background actors who don't have lines are some of the greats of New Zealand cinema.
Oh, really?
Or New Zealand screen. Jeanette MacDonald is a background actor. Nathaniel Lees is a background actor.
What?
And as Ashcroft shared with me when we chatted about it a few weeks ago, he said one of his favourite things about this was that he'd been hired by some of these people, he'd been fired by one of them, and that at the end of the day, seeing them in the bar with Lithgow and Rush and just swapping war stories was like his best experience of the films. It's, sometimes productions have the thing in them that you really hope they have, but you know, you kind of hope people have got time to hang out and have a drink and a laugh.
Yeah.
Obviously, making films is quite hard, so it's not really always the case, but it's nice to know on this occasion that the heavyweights of Aotearoa and international acting got to just sink a few and have a lol.
When you were hanging out with him, was he dressed impeccably? Like, was he wearing a really nice suit, James?
Through the Zoom, he was dressed impeccably. Every time I've seen him, he has been dressed impeccably. Yeah. Yep. Great mo.
Yeah. He used to collect, like, Cuban suits when I knew him in the late 90s and early 2000s. And he always just had, incredible.
What's the tell of a Cuban suit?
The way the cuffs were and the like a lapel thing. Yeah. And then with these beautiful like brown leather boots. Yeah, he's an immaculate man.
Well, while we're talking about the sort of behind the scenes shenanigans, it seems timely to bring up the new Seth Rogen comedy series, The Studio, which starts on Apple TV today.
Okay.
Seth Rogen plays a suit at a studio who finds himself catapulted into the head honcho job, and what he's trying to convince everybody of, particularly the filmmakers that he wants to court to make movies and the people he wants to impress, is like, I've always wanted to do this. I just want to make really good movies. I love movies. I just want to make good movies. But unfortunately, because it's Hollywood, you have to make movies like the Kool-Aid movie or other like IP shitters.
Yeah.
And while this may sound like a kind of familiar satire, and it is a satire, it does genuinely kind of embrace that concept of people in that business, most of them kind of do want to make decent movies. So there's kind of juggles the cynicism with a bit of a sort of a, it's not heartfelt, it's a comedy, it can be silly at times, but it's sort of looking at those dualities. And as far as sort of inside Hollywood shows or movies go, it's a really good example. The things I look out for when I'm watching a thing like an Entourage or whatever, right? It's like, how realistic are the movies within the movies and the kind of behind the scenes chaos on the sets? Here they're pretty decent. They're not too silly. Do they go to the places that they really go to in real life? Well, in the studio, they do go to Chateau Marmont. They do go to the Golden Globes. So they really are kind of taking on a good crack at inside Hollywood. And you've got to think in this that so many of the conversations that take place in the film, whether it's Catherine Hahn's hilarious turn as the head of the marketing department at the studio, who just kind of eviscerates kind of anything that gets put to her, to Rogan's own kind of follies and trying to juggle this idea of populism with making good movies, you've got to think there's a lot of conversations that they've heard themselves and are just kind of transplanting into the show. Recommend.
And who are the like movie stars in it, actual movie stars, or are they made up movie stars?
That's a good point. Yes, there are some actual stars acting, and then some of the cameos have included just like little names like Scorsese or Ron Howard or Sarah Polley or Olivia Wilde.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a pretty butty bunch of people making fun of themselves. There's something a little bit Kirby about Curb Your Enthusiasm, yeah, about some of the interactions, and particularly that, you know, that desire of a celebrity to kind of dial up their unpleasant side and kind of have a laugh at themselves. So,
okay.
So
is Scorsese curmudgeonly?
He's not curmudgeonly, but he's wanting to make a film, and he's kind of being bowing and scraping to the right amount to like get the money to make his movie, but then on the turn, when he kind of realizes how he's been sold out, yeah, it gets shitty.
Okay.
He's got a limited range as an actor.
Yeah,
and
right.
But he's always a delight
but
to watch.
But he's playing himself. He's not playing Martin Forfaithy.
No. No, it's not Martin Sorfacey. No.
Okay.
This is the studio. That's on Apple TV from tonight. And I think maybe it's the first two episodes tonight and then weekly, something like that. So it's definitely not a binge and one go situation.
Okay, that is
It's also a little bit frantic. There's a lot of winners in the show. There's a lot of like sort of 10 or 15 minute unbroken scenes.
Oh, yeah.
Seemingly unbroken scenes. A lot of camera movement. It's quite hectic and it's quite shouty. So you might actually find that one a week's actually about the right amount.
How long is it?
It's streaming, it's a bit elastic, but somewhere between 30 and 60 minutes an episode. This is one of the things I really like about the streaming era is while a lot of stuff may seem like it's been padded out kind of to get enough episodes for the run, just being able to make something that's the right length for an episode is really
nice.
Yeah,
I love that.
So 36 minutes is good. It's not 26 or 44.
I know, that must be
44.
So liberating, eh, for the... Yeah,
so just being able to go where it needs to go is one of the upsides to the content that we're drowning in at the moment. What are you drowning in at the moment?
I'm drowning in Carol and the End of the World. I had a running stab at Ross Anderson movie, The Pigeon Sits on the Bench Contemplating Its Existence.
I think these two things are kind of related to one another. They're both pretty patient watches.
Yeah, yeah.
One's definitely a bit more comedic and gloomy than the other, perhaps.
But I had to hire it from Apple TV, the Roy Anderson movie, and I just couldn't complete it. And now I have this unsatisfying feeling of, do I rehire it? What am I? Do you ever not get through? You have to get through.
That's a bad sign. It's a bad sign when even with time pressure, you can't complete the assignment.
Yeah, maybe that is a bad sign. You're right. Mm. Carol and the End of the World, however, it just makes you. I was talking about it with a friend, and it's just kind of like heartening that this is something that got across the line. Like all of the stuff in it is so. It feels quite refreshing for a cartoon.
Totally. For listeners unfamiliar, this is, I guess it's a comedy or an existential comedy about finding a sense of purpose in a purposeless environment where the world is going to end, but Carol kind of finds herself a bit stuffed without a routine, I guess, in part, and finds herself swept up in this kind of weird cosplay of people pretending to be in an office together.
Yeah, that is weird.
Or is it cosplay? Like, it's kind of like it's such a dilemma, and it really it does make you think about your own routines and how there's stuff that might not be that objectively healthy in your lifestyle, but it's actually stuff that helps you get through your day. It's like just little moments or behaviors.
I just adore the way life's ending. Make the most of it is manifested for all the side characters and just the weird trends that everyone's into.
Like, oh, absolutely.
Everyone's nude, everyone's hang gliding, everyone's just really living for the moment. And she just kind of doesn't feel like she can, it's brilliant.
I didn't think I'd go to an office building if the world was doomed, but I think I'd, after watching the show, I might be more likely to do that than nude hang gliding. But well, I guess we'll see when the time comes.
Yeah.
We're not far off.
Not far.
That's all I got for today.
That's beautiful. I am going to watch both of those things. I can't believe I haven't watched the Rule of Jenny Pen yet. Studio sounds pretty cool.
Movies, eh? Watching stuff. There's
watching
too much of it.
Stuff.
There's too much of it, but when it's good, it's worth it.
It's true. All right, thanks so much, Steve. That was Flixand That.
Real auteurs use star wipes.
That was Flixand That on 95BFM.